surprise. I'd once thought that life would be a straight progression, like an iron line through the wilderness. I knew better now. But looking out to that faded oval with my arms around Pat, I felt a certain joy in our maturity. After 40 years of marriage and raising a family, we had made it. To stand in Pomona amid the ruins was to make a neat and tidy circle. Small wonder that entrepreneurial instincts were strong in me even as a boy. I had been riding for prize money at horse shows and working as a stunt rider in movies since the age of 4, and even school was shaped around work in the stables. By the time I was 12, money-making schemes, some quite epic, began to hatch in my brain. One involved Coca-Cola bottles. My brother and I had been picking up bottles at horse competitions and bringing them home in the railroad car to earn the 2-cent deposits. In 1947, it was announced that the first big post-war rodeo was to be held at the competition grounds in Salinas, and visions of all those empty Coke bottles were too tempting to pass up. The outdoor grandstand was 5 stories high with a concrete wall behind and bench seating from top to bottom. The 20,000 spectators each day would stuff wrappers and spent bottles into the cavity below their seats and down into the off-limits area below. I went to Doc Leach in the competition grounds office with a proposal. Larry and I would clean up under the seats when the rodeo ended, just for the coins and stuff we might find. Doc Leach wondered vaguely why we might volunteer to do such work just for the odd coin, but he agreed. He wouldn't have known about either the deposit system or Coke itself, inventions too new for old Doc Leach. After the rodeo, however, our profits appeared to be in jeopardy. Before taking measure of our haul, I had asked my father to call a representative of the Coca-Cola bottling company. I had in mind a very busy scene. Wooden crates stacked by the doors, a line of trucks to take them away, with Larry and me in charge. But a Mr. Carlson of Coca-Cola warned us that people were catching on to the deposit idea and taking bottles home. We might do a great deal of work for almost nothing. When after the rodeo my brother and I first entered that cavernous space below the seats, we were greeted by an amazing spectacle. Sunlight filtered through the slatted seats like light through a Venetian blind, throwing wide stripes across ground that was ankle-deep in rubbish. Anxious to find that first bottle, we held it up to a shaft of light. It wasn't broken, and few were. We were safe. We were also knee-deep in work. It took us 2.5 months, working mostly at night, to complete the task. But at the end was a glass bonanza. 80,000 bottles, one for every ticket sold over the 4 days. A convoy of trucks did indeed cart the bottles away. Larry and I earned $800 each, then a small fortune. A tribute to the glass then used, only 1,000 bottles had broken. Some, remember, were dropped from a great height. In the local newspaper, Doc Leach cheerfully conceded. The rodeo association had missed out on quite a profit, and 2 young entrepreneurs had taken an old guy for a ride. He wouldn't make the same mistake again. The next year, when I went up to the high deserts of Nevada to bring back wild Mustangs for Doc Leach and the rodeo, our partnership would be more equitable. But the heady Coca-Cola success certainly led to my life-changing encounters with the wild horses through the summer that followed. Chapter 3. East of Eden. By 1949, when I was 14 years old, I had essentially been a professional rider for a decade. I never really had a childhood. My youth had been an apprenticeship dedicated almost exclusively to horses, and my amateur competitors in the show ring couldn't have known that the fuzzy-cheeked kid opposing them, on Ginger or Brownie, was a pro in every sense. Small wonder the trophies often went my way. I had grown up on rodeo grounds, and it was inevitable that one day rodeo competition would beckon and that one day I would heed the call. My father's credo was simple. If there was prize money, I was to try for it. And so I entered skeet shooting contests, chuck wagon races, I rode bulls and even bucking horses, though I loathed riding broncs and had no talent for it. At 14, I began to practice the rodeo event called bulldogging, which would prove to be the one at which I was most capable. Bulldogging started on ranches in Texas. Cowboys would have to hold herds of cattle together for hours at a time while various animals were singled out and roped, for veterinary treatment perhaps, or for branding. Occasionally, a grown animal would run out from the herd, and the cowboys would chase after him and turn him back. For their own amusement during the long hours on the range, they started to compete among themselves in this chase-and-turn work. Some tried jumping from their horses onto the animal's neck, turning him back using their bare hands. One day, a black cowboy named Bill Pickett rode after a steer, jumped on its head, leaned over and grabbed its upper lip in his mouth, and bit down hard. The animal was so surprised by the pain that it fell. This was the very method that the English bulldog used to drop deer. Pickett would then turn the animal around and drive it back into the herd. The ranch put him on tour to demonstrate his remarkable methods, which evolved into the event that we know today as bulldogging. In the modern version, two men on horseback dart after an adult horned steer. One stays on the right and hazes the animal to keep it going in a straight line. The other runs alongside it on the left-hand side and leaps off his horse. The aim is to land on the steer's neck. His goal is to throw the steer. The bulldogger would want to stick to the animal like glue to prevent falling underneath his hooves. He wraps an arm around the animal's horns and takes its nose in the crook of his elbow, then gives an almighty twist to the steer's neck. The forward impetus of the animal causes it to flip on its side. It's like performing a judo throw with a 700-pound steer at breakneck speed. When the steer's flanks hit the dust, the clock stops. Injuries to the animals are virtually nil. The cowboys are often not as lucky. I won the National Intercollegiate Rodeo Association, NIRA, bulldogging competition in 1957, and I did well to win it. Generally, rodeo championships go to cowboys from inland states such as Texas, Idaho, and Montana. My first steer was a bad draw. He was a big, slow-handling animal, and by the time I had thrown him, I was placed seventh in the event, with a time of 6.2 seconds. But I could still win the championship if I placed well in the second round. The two rounds are average to produce a final score. I drew for my second steer and got myself perhaps the best on offer. However, I drew in the slack, which meant my second round would fall late at night, long after the public had left the arena. Worse, by 10 p.m., a sleet storm blew up. Particles of ice dripped off our hats. There was no cover, and I piled whatever clothing I could find on my horse and myself. Every now and again, I would run around in circles for 10 minutes to keep my muscles warm. I trod my horse, called Miss Twist, in circles for the same reason. Just past midnight, with only two more bulldoggers to go, I got the call for my second round. My college crew, my teammates, were all drinking hot coffee, and they swore it was the best thing for me in these crazy conditions, so I took half a cup and drained it, though coffee and I did not agree. The bulldogger before me was in the chutes and ready to go. With the steer set on its way, the hazer's horse slipped on the muddy ground and failed to keep up. The young bulldogger found himself galloping alongside the steer with no one on the other side to keep it in a straight line. The steer peeled off to the right, and the boy got his horse over and alongside the steer as best he could. But by now the steer was running alongside the fence, and just as the boy leaned out to pitch from his horse, the steer carved a line to the left, toward the horse, and the rider was upended, bounced over the top of the steer and into the metal pipe and rail fencing. He hit his head on the upright post and lay still where he fell. The ambulance was called, and there was a sorrowful delay. The realization sank in that the boy had died instantly. The sound of his head hitting the upright had been ominously final. The weather further blackened our spirits. And to add to these increasingly desperate circumstances, I began to feel nauseous. The coffee was working away in my gut and producing the allergic reaction that I subsequently learned to avoid at all costs. While my stomach churned, I backed Miss Twist into the box and threw off the sheets, keeping her more or less out of the sleet and rain. I signaled to my hazer, Jack Roddy, that I was ready. The steer was let out, and I blew after him as fast as I could, Jack Roddy's horse maintaining his grip in the mud and keeping the steer in a straight line for me. I leapt from my saddle onto the steer's neck, and with a giant twist of his head, I brought him down in 4.3 seconds. I knew as soon as I felt him hit the turf that this great score meant I had earned myself a national championship in bulldogging. When my college crew ran over to applaud me, they found me staring at the ground, almost embracing it. The allergy had taken effect, and I was more sick than I believed possible. I threw up everything, even my heels. The crew put it down to overexcitement, and I could not draw a breath to tell them otherwise and to plead. Could they please stop pounding on the back of such a sick and sorry man? Of all the events performed in the rodeo, perhaps the most dangerous is bull riding. In bull riding, your life depends on the draw. After your ride, the bull receives a score between 1 and 50 for his efforts, and the rider receives a score in that same range for his. You might even call it a team event. Each contestant has 8 seconds to stay right side up on a professional rodeo bull. Bulls are more ferocious in their tactics than bucking horses. Horses arch their backs, curl their heads between their front legs, and jump, stiff-legged, in a pogo stick type of action, all of which is difficult enough. Bulls, on the other hand, have extraordinary strength and traction in their cloven feet that allows them to dive, then twist to the left, come down again, crack into a right spin, and so on. A bull is like a hairy, snorting roller coaster. You hold on to the braided rope around his middle, and 8 seconds on a bull's back can seem like a lifetime. Of course, once you jump off or are thrown, the bull straightaway turns and heads for you. His intentions are clear. He wants to see you as dust under his feet. So-called clowns run into the ring and distract his attention, which they do with any number of humorous antics. The clowns are amazing athletes and bullfighters who risk everything to entertain the crowd and save cowboys from injury. When I got married, Pat asked me to give up bull riding since competitors are particularly prone to serious injury. She argued that my other rodeo events would improve without the stress and strain of bull riding. I agreed, and it took no more than one rodeo event to prove her right. Still, long afterward, I would have strange flashes about bull riding. At a rodeo, I'd find myself worrying about which bull I had drawn. Then remember, without knowing it, I had been suffering from enormous tension, and I was glad of Pat's advice. Most rodeo events evolved from common working practices on the ranch. In team roping, a pair of dayhands would rope the steer's head and hind feet and stretch them out on the ground. Using a medicinal kit carried in their saddlebags, the two might have to deal with a hunk of barbed wire around his leg or a foxtail in his eye. Ranch horses were trained to maintain the tension on the rope until the job was done. Rodeo took that task and turned it into a competition, team roping. I was to win the NIRA National Championship in team roping in 1956. To win that title requires a year of preparation. Once in Scottsdale, Arizona, Jack Roddy and I had drawn a perfect steer. He was steady and moved in a straight line. In my mind, this steer was important if we were going to get things going for the year. The steer was in the chute. Jack, the header, was behind the barrier to the left. I, the heeler, was in position on the right. A piece of string is attached to the steer. When he takes off, he goes a prescribed distance before the string trips the latch holding a cord across the front of the header's horse. A 10-second fine is imposed if the header breaks through the cord. The trick, an art, really, is to have the horse moving forward just as the cord is released. On this occasion, Jack Roddy timed it perfectly. In the arena, he threw a great loop. A time below 10 seconds, and the championship trophy appeared before me like a vision. I was on a horse called Bernie, and he shot off after the steer that Jack was drawing across our path. I leaned out, my loop built and whirling above my head well within range, and suddenly I had no horse. Bernie took a dive and somersaulted, throwing me onto my chin. In my hands was a rope, one end of it tied to the steer's hind feet. With a neat bucking action, the steer pulled it through, and the palms of my hands were like hamburger, practically smoking. Logically, I should have let the rope go, but my subconscious had taken over. I had to apologize to Jack Roddy. No trophy. Albuquerque, New Mexico was a different story. We drew a steer that rodeo competitors call a blue screamer. He was more like a racehorse than a bovine. "Don't worry," said Jack. "We'll beat those potlickers." Potlicker was a derogatory term for the competition. When everyone else had finished lunch, a potlicker got to lick the pot. The steer was in his chute, wringing his tail, anxious to run, and Jack and I were lined up. Jack had his horse Chongo backed all the way up in the chute, aiming to time it so he pushed through the court at a full gallop. The steer lit out of the chute like it was on fire, and Jack rolled Chongo forward just as the string was tightening. He had Chongo flat out after only a few strides, and he roped the steer's head with a superb long throw. However, the long rope meant it was more difficult for me because the steer was swinging back and forth in a long arc. I had Bernie on his tail, and I could see his hind feet going quicker than I thought possible. I faced a 12-to-14-foot throw instead of the usual 4 or 5. Bernie was practically scratching his inside ear on the ground, leaning that hard into the corner to get me close enough to rope the critter's heels. But this was the only chance I'd get, and I had no time to widen my loop. I made the throw of a lifetime, and the steer's hind legs ran into the coil. We had him laid out flat on the ground, and the field judge dropped the flag in less than 8 seconds. The world championship was mine. As a young man in the rodeo arena, I did more calf roping than I care to admit. In the calf roping event, a small 200-pound bovine scatters from the gate, moving more nimbly than the bigger animals. Dexterity is the name of the game. A cowboy races after him. As he builds his loop and closes in, the calf knows he's there. He ducks his head and flattens his ears, expecting his pursuer, as a predator, to catch him on the back of the neck. The cowboy throws the loop around the calf's head, keeping the other end of the rope tied around the horn of his saddle. All in one motion, the horse stops hard, the roper dismounts, and the calf is jerked off his feet and lands with a thud on its side. The cowboy runs at him with a small length of rope in his teeth, waiting for the calf to rise to his feet. The roper's task is to throw the calf to the ground again and then wind the rope around any three of his legs, usually one front leg and both rear legs. The instant the cowboy completes the tie and throws his hands in the air, the field judge drops his flag and the clock stops. Calf roping is not a pleasant event, and bears no comparison with what actually happens on a ranch. Roping calves is a necessary practice for branding, castration, and medical purposes, but the calf is allowed to run with the rope and is brought to a halt slowly. Usually calves are roped by a team to minimize stress on the calf. I recently did a day's roping on a neighborhood ranch, and my horse, Dooley, a champion reined and cutting horse, never broke out of a walk during the whole day's work. Ranchers prefer it this way. These babies, after all, are their livelihood. Protests against calf roping on the rodeo circuit have increased to such an extent that now the event is seldom seen by the paying public. It still takes place, but in the slack when the seats are empty. As for bronc riding, another competition that stirred an outcry, the distress that some people feel for broncs is misplaced. The bronc is not just any wild animal. He's a highly prized specialist. Not many horses are suited for the work. Far from being a cruel sport, this is a competition event in which the horse truly enjoys himself. The champion bronc is a valuable animal who gets the best care and nutrition. He's not bored by repetitive exercises, like many horses working in other rodeo events or in the Western show horse categories. He's respected as a bronc. He's a wild thing, and nobody spends hours trying to bend his will. He quickly learns that he has nothing to fear. He's taken into the chute, a man gets on him, and the gate opens. The bronc then does as he pleases, and what pleases him is to put that rider on the ground. It's a good life. In 1949, a group of American Amateur Equestrian Associations banded together and established rules for a new amateur contest called Horse Mastership, open to anyone under the age of 18. They laid a grid on the map, and each state was divided into districts. The winner would climb a ladder from district to state to regional competition. At the end of this long trail of hard work, the reward was to be invited to the international final of the Horse Mastership contest, held in New York. Parents across the country entered their children in this enormous and comprehensive competition. Surely the nation's gross national product dropped during the few years the all-consuming contest was held. My brother and I entered the first year. It was a hot day in Santa Rosa, California, and we were roasted in more ways than one. We were unprepared and came home losers. Within days, we began to prepare for the 1950 Horse Mastership title. Next time I did better. Victorious in the district, I went to the state competition at Palm Springs. Judges had numbered different bits and bridles and ancillary equipment, and we were asked to name them. For every buckle and strip of leather, I gave a crisp answer. The judges might have taken my confidence as patronizing, but they liked the philosophy behind the phrase I repeated over and over, and they gave me full marks. The most important part of any bit or horse headgear, I told them, are the hands that hold it. I won. But it was no surprise. I'd been training horses for this event obsessively for 2 years in the manner of an adult professional, yet I was pitched against young people who undertook their horsemanship more as a hobby. When I traveled to New York to win the final event with points to spare, I was still only 15. Nearly all the other 20 finalists were at the maximum age of 18. 15 of them came from various states in the United States. The rest were from Canada, Mexico, Panama, Puerto Rico, South Africa, and Argentina. Between the rodeos and the showgrounds and the horse mastership contests and all the traveling on the railroad car, I did manage to fit in a little time at school, but my attendance record was slim. It consisted mostly of turning up on examination days to prove that I was up to the standard. I was, though, registered with the local Catholic school administered by Notre Dame nuns. One nun, Sister Agnes Patricia, was the most influential teacher I ever knew. What I'd always remember about her is her statement that there is no such thing as teaching, only learning. She believed that no teacher could ever teach anyone anything. Her task as a teacher was to create an environment in which the student can learn. Knowledge, she told us, standing very straight in her long black habit, her face framed by her white wimple pointed at the top like the spire of a cathedral, needs to be pulled into the brain by the student, not pushed into it by the teacher. Knowledge is not to be forced on anyone. The brain has to be receptive, malleable, and most important, hungry for that knowledge. I apply the same philosophy to training horses. To use the word teach implies an injection of knowledge. Like Sister Agnes Patricia, I came to agree that there's no such thing as teaching, only learning. When I was 16, Larry and I were part of a mad enterprise, a roundup of wild steers that had the look and feel of a wild goose chase, in the dark. A woman named Dorothy Tavernetti owned the Laguna Seca Ranch, 15 miles south of Salinas and some 6,000 acres in size. In 1950, she became the financial backer of an enthusiastic rodeo cowboy, Trevor Hageman, who specialized in team roping, and they may have been connected romantically as well. She bought batches of young Mexican Corriente steers with long horns in which Trevor could practice his roping. My brother and I would go over 3 times a week to practice as well. Within 3 or 4 months, the steers got too heavy and stopped running. They grew weary of being roped all the time. Instead of selling them, Trevor would turn them out on the range and Dorothy would buy another batch of steers for him. The cattle lived on the range and grew bigger and bigger. When a year later, Dorothy grew disenchanted with Trevor and asked him to leave, she decided to sell all the steers that had been put out on her ranch. The first group of 400 steers were easy to round up and were shipped off to market. But the remaining 100 head were now quite wild. You were lucky to glimpse them in the daylight hours and only rarely at night. Dorothy's hired hands concluded it was impossible to catch them. She didn't accept this defeatist attitude, however, and contracted Ralph Carter to catch her renegade cattle. Ralph and Vivian had been our partners in the Mustang roundups, and since roping was a part of our lives, Ralph asked Larry and me, then 15 and 16, to help. We felt like rustlers, for the roundup would take place under cover of darkness. The first few nights we were able to gather about 40 head without too much difficulty. The remaining 60 head, however, were elusive. Ralph devised a plan. He would drive out with a load of hay in the pickup and feed them on open, flat areas 5 miles from the ranch house. It was high summer, and food was in short supply. The cattle quickly found the new hay and would listen for the pickup as it came at 9 or 10 at night. They grew to like the sound of the truck's engine. Once this routine was established, Ralph hid Larry and me on horseback in the trees nearby. While the steers were eating the dropped hay, we were to break from the trees and gallop through the darkness, heading them off before they could reach the safety of the brush. The task was to rope a steer in near darkness. It was hair-raising to be riding hellishly fast over broken ground, trying to see enough by the scant moonlight to rope some of the wildest steers known to humankind. You only knew you had caught one when you felt the sudden yank on the line. It was like fishing in the dark. We'd hold the captured steer with a dolly, the rope wrapped around the horn of the saddle, until Ralph arrived with the truck and trailer. We then passed the ropes through the front of the trailer, so that by pulling from in front and pushing from behind, the steers were drawn up and into the trailer. Over 6 nights, we captured 12 steers in this fashion. The remaining 48 grew wise and wouldn't be tempted from the brush. Ralph had to devise another plan. This time, Larry and I left headquarters on horseback, heading north of the cattle. We then pressed south, driving any cattle ahead of us through the brush into the open areas, where we ran the horses flat out to catch the steers before they thought to circle back to cover. I was chasing a steer I could barely see when it ran into a small clump of oak trees. I was concentrating hard on not riding into a low-hanging limb. The steer obviously knew that in the center of this clump of trees lay a deep pit. He also knew, though Brownie and I did not, about a trail that skirted round the edge of the pit. When the steer suddenly veered off, we continued on, airborne, down into the pit. I was thrown over Brownie's head, and as I passed over his ears, accidentally caught my hand on the crown of the bridle. I found myself at the bottom of a 16-foot pit, standing in sand up to my knees. In my left hand was the whole bridle and part of a rope. In my right hand was my loop, still built. Brownie stood beside me in sand up to his knees and hocks. Outwitted by a steer. I felt sore about this, but I was less pleased to discover that this 50-foot-wide pit was truly a sand trap. I'd scramble up the side, hang on by the tips of my fingers, then slide back down again. Once or twice I reached the top, but couldn't persuade Brownie to join me. I was spitting dust, and my boots were full of stones. It took me half an hour to fight my way out of there, horse included. Back at the pickup, they were wondering what had happened to me. Larry and I began to make inquiries about our salaries and whether danger pay ought to be included. Our fee was a meager $10 per steer. But we carried on anyway because we were having fun. Finally, there remained about 20 steers to capture, and Ralph had yet another new plan. We had learned that the steers were frightened only of the horses, whom they could smell from afar. Horses were their nemeses. But they still liked the sound of the pickup and the hay that came with it. We'd use subterfuge. Ralph stowed me in the back of the pickup, well hidden but with a loop already built. The other end of the rope was attached to the trailer hitch. Ralph drove slowly through the herd while I tossed flakes of hay over the side from my position lying supine in the bed of the pickup. Ralph was muttering out the side window in a low voice. Three coming up now on the left side. At an opportune moment, I leapt from my hiding place and roped a steer. Ralph gunned the accelerator and jerked the steer to the ground. Larry and I jumped on the steer and held him down while Ralph got a rope around his horns. We then tied him to a tree to be picked up later in the trailer. We were doing very well with this method until the accident. I reckon the steers were going to be on the right side of the truck, but they turned and approached us from the left. As usual, I jumped up, but then had to face in the other direction to throw the loop. I didn't stop to think about where the rest of the rope was lying. As Ralph accelerated, the rope, caught around me, whipped up, crossed over my left cheekbone, and slammed my head into the tailgate. He dragged the steer for 30 yards while the rope massaged my head. I was unconscious for several hours. I woke in the hospital with bandages covering my head and wondering what had happened. We eventually caught all the steers and made a fair amount of money for those nights' work. We were lucky to live through it, but it was fun and taught us to see in the dark. During my trips to Nevada, I'd become acutely aware that Brownie was due an apology from us. In the high desert, I had seen how he must have been brought up. Predators aside, it had looked to me to be idyllically happy. Brownie would have been raised in a close family group, with affection tempered by discipline, and with all the security of a large extended family communicating effectively with one another. It had then been wrenched into an alien environment and right away beaten and frightened into submission. I had taken it upon myself to try to make up for the sacking out procedure. I talked to him all the time, listened to him, gave him the best possible care. I wanted to do everything right for him. His health was always good. I thought carefully about his diet. I read his every mood. And he had responded. He'd become as close as a brother to me. Save for his paper phobia, he was a steady and well-adjusted horse. He had recovered, I think, as well as could be expected. However, not long after our steer roping adventure together, when he was 14 and I was 17, I began to notice a sorrowful air come over him in the stable, a certain reluctance when I swung into the saddle. He wasn't crisp and ready for the day as he usually was. Concerned, I began to experiment with his diet and exercise. One of Brownie's favorite exercises was one I had devised to practice for the healing event and rodeo competition. I didn't always have a header to work with me, so I trained one steer to cooperate with us in these training sessions. The steer's job was to hold in one corner of a large rectangular pen. We'd gallop toward him, and the steer would run toward the center. Brownie's task, and he excelled at it, was to execute a U-turn, placing his right shoulder near the left hip of the steer, giving me a perfect opportunity to rope the hind legs. Both Brownie and the steer seemed to enjoy the game. But when I included a touch more of this favorite activity in Brownie's training schedule, his apathy seemed worse rather than better. Suddenly it hit me. He was bored with me. He needed a holiday. A young person as driven as I was will almost always overwork his horse. And despite all the attention I gave Brownie, it had proven too much. I had crowded his life with my own. I realized this only weeks before the biggest horse show of the year in Salinas. Were we to duck out of it and give up all we had worked for? More than ever, I wished that we shared the same language. One day I leaned into Brownie's stall and had a conversation with him. I put an arrangement to him. Brownie, I'll love you from Monday to Friday, feed and exercise you from Monday to Friday, but I won't badger you or bother you. You can do what you want during the week. In return, can you give me everything you've got on Saturday and Sunday? Knowing he couldn't understand, but fresh with the knowledge I'd gained in Nevada, I made a promise to him that I would dedicate my life to understanding his language. This was a vow made to a horse, but solemn nonetheless. I meant to keep it. On that day, which was a focal point in my life, I set out on my goal. My ambitions became focused from that point. Brownie won everything at the Salinas show. It was as though he did understand. These were the last summers spent on the railroad car traveling to horse shows. The shows themselves were a flurry of activity and hard work. My father employed an advance man to sort out transportation from rail yard to show ground, to identify where we could restock with provisions and, more important, to sell as many tickets as possible to a clinic I would put on after the weekend shows, often on a Monday evening. Miss Parsons took the gate money and banked our share. She kept accounts in a steel box that would then be pored over by her and by my father, though I wasn't privy to that. The advance man also secured the venue for the clinic. Often the tickets were sold to clubs and schools. The advertised appeal was, "Monty can show you how to win." My father no doubt hit on this initiative to help cover the considerable cost involved in hauling the railroad car around the country with all those horses and two full-time employees. He must have needed more than my prize money to keep that show on the road. At the shows, I generally won everything. And why not? I had Brownie. Plus up to 8 highly trained horses to mop up any prizes left over. I was a professional with years of experience behind me. The American Horse Shows Association recognized me as a professional, but didn't exclude me from entering amateur competitions as long as I was within the qualifying age. I competed against boys and girls who might enter 2 or 3 horse shows a summer and only ride on weekends. Horsemanship was their fun, not their life's work. In a way, I was a freak occurrence on the show circuit in those years. At the clinics, I was supposed to reveal the secret of my success before what we hoped was an enthusiastic audience. Brownie was on hand so young riders could see the famous champion horse. I listened hard to every question and gave as much advice as I could. I spoke about equipment, work ethic, training. I watched my pupils' horses and counseled what should be done with them next. I learned to project my voice and speak clearly. I felt a great weight of responsibility because all these riders had paid and deserved the best attention. But for all that, the clinics could never deliver what they promised. The secret of my success was a life obsession with horses. I'd look at the eager young faces lined up before me. No youngsters were going to dedicate 6 to 7 hours a day to riding, and no parents would let them. Sometimes I felt sorry for those kids. But just as often I felt sorry for myself. My life during those summers was like that of young evangelists who travel the country preaching. In many ways, it was a trying existence. Not having had the opportunity to behave as a child, I was separate, isolated, with a different set of values from most young people. I never visited a toy shop, for instance, never possessed a toy as a child. Only much later did that fact strike me as odd. I'd see a child go into a shop, point at a train set or a doll, and say, "Can I have that one, please?" It struck me that I had never done that, and I felt an overwhelming sense of regret. On the other hand, because my world was focused so tightly on horses, I was prone to think I was better than anyone else, and that I possessed unique qualities. After all, I was the high-profile junior horseman on the North American show ring circuit. Behind my father's back, I had started to investigate the silent language of equus. I couldn't wait to be free of him and to start using my own methods. Luckily, Miss Parsons kept my feet on the ground, reminding me that the whole circus of our operation offered tremendous opportunities for both adventure and education. She kept me humble, pointing out that my success owed a great deal to the many hours of work I put in, which my competitors could not. There were no magic wands in my possession, no mystical qualities unique to Monty Roberts. But I was already more man than boy. In terms of my life experience, my travel, and my education, I was a man in his 20s. Even my body carried the message that I was older than my years. I turned to weightlifting, and my 190 pounds was spread over a powerful frame with a 48-inch chest. Silently, I was conveying a message to my father. I will be bigger than you. When I won the Mr. Salinas Jr. bodybuilding contest, my father ridiculed me. We were like two bulls, and though the younger one still feared the older, time, as it always is, was on the side of the young. The already strained relationship between us grew increasingly difficult. As a boy reaching manhood, I had good reason to believe I should be testing my wings. We had many aborted conversations about starting to train horses using my own methods. What was wrong with his methods? He'd ask. He'd done pretty well with them. What was there to change? He wanted his ways to be my ways. He couldn't conceive that I might do anything other than what he had taught me. The mere thought of it stirred anger in him. At 15, I had wanted to play football and try out for the wrestling team, but he'd have none of that. I might as well have asked his permission to fly to the moon. Anything that took me away from the life he had made for me was beyond contemplation. He had given me my first breath, and he owned the ones that came after. I'd try again. Maybe you could release some of the income I earned from the motion pictures I did, so I could buy some equipment? What money? You used that up long ago. Okay, what about the clinics we just held? He'd counter with a question of his own. Who paid for your education? Who paid for your room and board? Who paid for your upbringing? Then he made the point crystal clear. I, as your father, am responsible for everything you've done, and you owe me, not vice versa. Sometime later, I was in the house talking with my mother, explaining to her how working with the Mustangs over the last few years had taught me a great deal. Like what? She asked. Something very important. For instance, I just know that no one needs to sack out a young horse anymore. I'm doing it a different way. I don't even hit a horse once, not ever. Not the way I do it. I don't even tie a rope to their heads before I ride them. Well, she said, that sounds like a lot happier way of doing things. Just then a movement caught my eye, and I turned and saw my father. He was staring at me from the doorway, and I knew he'd caught the drift of my conversation. He stepped forward wearing a hard, unforgiving look. I knew what that meant. He stepped in front of us, his color heightened by his terrible fury. The veins stood out in his neck as he shouted, I don't want to hear any more of this sort of talk. Dad? He shouted louder, one of his hands curling into a fist, the other jabbing at my chest. You're ungrateful to me.
I'm not.
You're too stupid to do anything without my help. I swallowed hard, knowing what was coming, as my mother pleaded,
Marvin, please.
You owe everything to me. With that, he raised his fist to his opposite ear and brought it back across my face, knocking my jaw hard. On this day, finally, I wasn't going to take it. I advanced on him, my hands on his arms, and backed him against a wall. I looked him in the eye, and he seemed to grow a little smaller. I had anger now to match his, and I came within a hair of unleashing it. I felt then what I've occasionally felt since but always resisted, an urge to strike. But at that moment the chain of violence was broken. I wouldn't be like him, either with other humans or with my animals. I registered that my mother had screamed briefly. I heard my mother say to him, Marvin, stop at once. She had his arm and was staring at him hard, like she wanted to turn him to stone.
Listen to him for once, she said. Let's just see what he has to say. He's not a child.
We moved slightly apart and he dropped his shoulders. He wasn't afraid of me, but he wore a look of shock and resignation. Listen, huh? He said as though anything I said wouldn't be worth much. Nevertheless, he went quiet. We moved to the living room, and he sat on a couch by himself while my mother stood close by me. Something clicked,
I recognized my opportunity. This was no conversation now. I was telling him what was going to happen. I want to start up on my own. I figure there are people who will give me work training their horses, and I want to be left to do as I think fit. I want a chance to prove I can do it. It's not much to ask. It's only what anyone in Salinas could do. Lease some facilities from you so they can work with horses here at the grounds, same as Ray Hackworth or anybody else. There was a moment's pause while my father digested what he had just heard.
A look of disbelief stole over his face. Then he said, "Good, you can do just that. I'll rent you barn number 8, course I will, and we'll see how you get on."
Then he stood up and pointed a finger at me. "And while you're about it, since you're so damned grown up all of a sudden, you can pay us money for your board. You can buy your own vehicle and your own clothes." His parting shot was, "The rent for your room here is $35 a month." The rent for the entire house on Church Street had been $35 a month. He wanted to show me the kind of payments he faced, and by setting such a high rent, he thought he was sowing the seeds of my failure. Nevertheless, I eagerly accepted the arrangement. He named my mother as administrator for all the various charges and the days she was to expect them. I took him at his word and opened for business as a trainer of show horses and cutting horses. In other ways, too, I made it clear that I was now in charge of my own destiny. Rodeos would no longer dominate my time. I joined the football and wrestling teams at school. As far as making a living, I was a world champion horseman, was I not? Surely there'd be more than enough work training other people's horses. Reality struck home quickly. Had it not been for my mother helping me out surreptitiously most of the time, forgetting a month's rent here and there and slipping me some cash when she saw I needed it, I certainly would have crashed quickly and would have had to find myself a job digging ditches. But my mother cheated on my behalf in ingenious ways. She bought pants, supposedly for my father, but in my size, so she could give them to me instead. Without her adjusting the accounts in this way, my father would have been right, and I wouldn't have survived. Thanks to her, I was out from under him for the first time in my life. It was a start. I was mounted on Brownie, standing in one corner of the corral. In the other corner stood one steer. While Brownie jigged on the spot, wanting to be set loose and run at the steer, I counted the seconds and judged when to give the command. I gave a cluck and he jumped forward in the usual gleeful way. Brownie ran in, rolling the steer out of the corner and bouncing it out from along the rails, his particular skill. Suddenly he felt all wrong beneath me. As if his nervous system was plugged into mine, I felt the sharp, fearful breakdown within him just as he did. When he stumbled and made a crashing fall, this was no horse stripping over a piece of rough ground. This was the rug pulled out from under his feet. By the time I stood up, I knew he was dead. He was lying on the ground, not moving a muscle. A terrible grief overtook me. I couldn't imagine life without this horse as my friend and companion. I suffered true bereavement, as bad as any I've known. I stood there for a long while in dumb silence, not doing a thing. As I stood there, I remembered. I remembered first seeing that single white dot between his eyes. Remembered hearing his name, Brownie. Standing nose to tail with Oriole in the pale moonlight up on the high desert in Nevada. Rocking back and forth in the railroad car, keeping his balance. Walking forward to collect many, many championship trophies as a working horse. Spinning calves out of the corner of the corral. I set about to bury him where he died, at the south end of the competition grounds. The ground was rock hard, and I went at it with a pick and shovel. To my surprise, my father understood my sorrow. He rented an air chisel for me so I could break through. It was the kindest thing he ever did for me.
The old grounds at Salinas were recently rebuilt, and one of the mementos I plucked from it was a board from Brownie's stall. Not that I needed anything to remember him by. It's a bitter pill to watch a horse die, but to lose one you love is to lose a part of yourself. The tears don't stop coming for a long time. "Rest in peace," I said to Brownie as I laid him in his grave. I meant it. Mr. Fowler paced back and forth at the head of the class, while we waited with our pencils sharpened and our paper at the ready. A tall man with an erect bearing and an olive complexion, he always dressed immaculately. "I want you all to think about this very carefully," the teacher said, waving his long, elegant hands. "It should be like painting a picture of your lives in the future, as if all your ambitions had been realized." A voice piped up. "How much detail do you want, sir?" "As much as possible. It should be a complete portrayal of what you envision for yourself in the future." He turned to gaze at us calmly. "And my last instruction to you is perhaps the most important. This vision should be realistic. I don't want to hear about some crazy off-the-wall plan. I don't want to know about any Hollywood dreams, either." There was a smattering of laughter at this. We were in California, after all. Mr. Fowler ended, "It should be a fair and accurate assessment of where I might expect to find you if I were to visit you in your mid-30s. It's to be called My Goals in Life and should be returned within 3 weeks. In my last year of high school, I knew precisely what I wanted to do with my life. From the time I was 9, I had been sketching plans for stables and training facilities. Mine was no Hollywood dream. I turned in what I thought was a good paper that captured my life's ambition. A ground plan and associated paperwork for the operation of a thoroughbred racehorse facility. 5 days later, the paper was returned to me with a big red F printed across the top of the page, along with the traditional words, See me. This was a shock, because I normally got good grades. Essay in hand, I went immediately to see Mr. Fowler after class and asked him what I had done wrong. He leafed through the pages. You know that my last instruction to you was to be realistic in this projection of your future? Yes, I did realize that. Do you realize that the average annual income of a person in the United States is $6,300? I had a clear idea of what was coming. So how many years would you have to work and save up to earn the amount of money you'd need for your plan? He asked me. I don't know. He snapped his finger against the red F and advised me. It's a wild, unattainable dream. I gave it a failing grade based on the instructions I issued at the outset. He handed me back the paper. I know your family and background. It would just not be possible. Take it home, think about it, change your vision to an appropriate level, and hand it in again. The last thing I want is to fail you based on a misunderstanding. It felt like he had driven a knife into me. So unexpected was his reaction. I was suddenly awakened to the reality of finance, and I faced the prospect that my dream was of the impossible kind. The next few days were depressing. I agonized over what to do. My mother saw I was troubled and inquired, so I confided in her. She read my paper and suggested, "Well, if that's truly your life's dream, then in my opinion, you can achieve it. I think you ought to consider turning the paper back in just the way it is, without any changes." She added, "If you think it's unattainable, then you can change it yourself. But I don't think it's for a high school instructor to set a level on your hopes and dreams." My mother was a meek woman, but this is one of the few times I saw her angry. I felt renewed. I returned to school and handed the paper back, this time with a note attached to Mr. Fowler. I told him that while he had every right as my instructor to call my life plan unattainable, I didn't see it that way. I further suggested that he didn't have the right to put a cap on my aspirations, but that he should grade the paper as he saw fit. When the grades were mailed to us at the end of the year, I got an A for that particular course. I never did find out to what extent my teacher changed the mark,
but clearly an F on the project would have scuttled any chance for a top grade. I would encounter Lyman Fowler much later in my life. He'd have more to say on the subject of hopes and dreams. One night in the summer of 1953, I was in the railroad car, winding through the Imperial Valley in California. It was still strange not having Brownie with me. We had spent so long together in this rattling wood structure as it rolled around the vast countryside. His was a ghostly presence, especially at night. I had gone back over the roof of the train to the caboose where the railroad crew rode. Nothing much was happening. The cards were put away and no one was drinking or eating. I was looking out the window into the moonlit desert of Southern California. Quite suddenly, the image of a young lady named Patricia Burden came into my mind as clearly as if I had invited her to sit by me. It struck me that she was going to be a major factor in my life. Pat Burden had been 1 year behind me through primary and secondary school. Her father owned a major company that drilled and installed water wells, but she had relatives who were involved in the horse business and in rodeo as well. What to do next preyed on me. This was not a decision I had made. It was as if someone else were pulling the strings. Once home, I went up to her in the corridor of Salinas Union High School and simply informed her that she was my chosen woman, or words to that effect. She had a different reading and shooed me away. Pat was then involved with someone in an on-again, off-again relationship. Curiously, I discovered later that in grade school she did have a crush on me, and even named her black cocker spaniel Monty Blue. But that was then. Monty Blue, the dog, had since been run over. This was now. Soon after my announcement in the corridor, Pat was with friends, Sally and Jim Martins, who happened to be related to my family, and she told them I was pestering her every day for a meeting of some sort, suggesting no end of things we might do together. They dared Pat to go out with me just once. Not being the type to turn down a dare, she said she would. The next day I made my usual overture. This time she said yes to a date. Dinner and a movie. Since then we've been together for more than 40 years. A major Hollywood picture was scheduled to be shot in and around Salinas in the summer of 1954. It was to be called East of Eden, from the book by John Steinbeck, who had been a Salinas resident in the early years of the century. I'd gone to school with members of his family. The director was to be the noted filmmaker Elia Kazan. He had cast a kid from a New York stage school in the main role, and naturally the producers were worried about asking a city boy to play the part of a small-town Californian. Our old friend Don Page was the first assistant director on the film, and he suggested that I take this young, unknown actor under my wing and show him around, let him live with me for a while, to help him soak up the local atmosphere. I thought it was a terrible idea, imagining some drama school graduate slowing me down. But when Don pointed out that there was a $2,500 payment for the 3 months, plus food allowances, I saw what a sensible plan it was after all. What's the actor's name? James Dean. He turned up at the competition grounds with a little suitcase, wearing jeans, a t-shirt, and a leather jacket. He was disheveled and careless, goofy and irreverent, unstructured and confident. He was 23 years to my 20, but it seemed the other way around. He was young for his age. I took his bag and showed him to my room, where I gave him the top bunk. Then I noticed his boots. They were a city slicker's idea of cowboy boots, with the jeans an inch too short to show more of the leather. I said nothing at first, but then could bear it no longer. We had a clothing allowance for him, and I suggested we go to the Garcia Saddlery store to buy him some real boots. Jimmy was stoic about it, though he wanted to hang on to his original pair. "If you don't burn them by the time we're through," I told him, "I won't have done my job properly." A little later, when he was comfortable with his new footwear, he gave the original boots away. The boots episode tipped us into a firm friendship. He would sit on the fence and watch Pat and me riding, either at shows or in the practice corrals. We went to Mac's Cafe and had dinner. We introduced him to everyone we could. He'd melt into the corners and sit balled up, running his fingers through his hair. I advised him to straighten up, to come out of his shell, not to slink back all the time if he wanted to appear like a Salinas-born Steinbeck character.
Yeah, I'll do that, he replied, unconcerned.
Then with genuine interest, he would ask,
Can you show me how to spin that rope?
We sat up till 3 a.m, teaching him to do the butterfly. Jimmy thought that mastering that spin would be his ticket to local social acceptance. He was right. He did it everywhere, showing off his new trick while the assembled company nodded their heads in approval. He also wanted a pair of chaps. He'd borrow mine and wear them to horse shows, but for a spectator to wear the uniform of a competitor was considered poor form, and he soon stopped. He was pleased when I gave him an old pair of my father's chaps. Jimmy fell in love with Pat and followed her around like a puppy. He was never a threat because he never advanced his case. He simply looked at her all the time. And wherever she went, he would go too. After the 3 months were up, Don Page and Ilya Kazan called me in for a meeting. They were close to shooting now, and they wanted to know how their young prospect had fared. I told them I really liked him, that he was like a brother to me, and that I was impressed with his character, with everything about him. I had to add one caveat, though. I knew plenty